Okay, I want to welcome you to our fifth and final class on class analysis. And today what we're going to focus on is using the class analysis we have been developing and applying to a variety of topics to apply it to what in many ways may be the most important topic we could apply it to, which is an analysis of the possibilities for social change, and particularly for social change on the left, from the left, here in the United States. And to do that, I'm going to break it down into two parts. First, I'm going to talk a little bit in class analytical terms. I'm going to use the class analysis to understand something about the basic history of the labor movement in the United States and the left in the United States. And the second part of what I want to do is to draw the lessons from that history in terms of what might be a new, a different, and a more successful strategy than the one that I'm going to explain has been followed in the past, again, always using the class analytical terms, that is, looking at class in terms of surplus, of the production of surplus by some people, its appropriation by other people, this capitalist arrangement that we went through, and how that surplus then gets distributed. So let me begin with a very brief, because we don't have the time, sketchy history of labor and the left here in the United States. First, labor. Labor in the United States has focused, above all else in its strategy, on organizing workers here in the United States into trade unions, labor unions, in order to, using their language, bargain collectively with their employer. In other words, to change the deal from having an individual worker negotiate with an individual employer about the job, the working conditions, the pay scale, and so on, and rather to bargain with an employer, but collectively, so that all the workers are unionized, are gathered together in a union, literally what the word means, so as to confront the employer as a group and have, therefore, more bargaining power. The employer can't play one worker off against another because they are unified in a union that bargains for all the workers as a collective. Okay? That's been their goal. And what is it they bargain over? Above all else, and I mean almost exclusively, they bargain over the terms of the labor contract. Literally. How much am I going to get paid? Number one. And what are the conditions of my work? Number two. My medical leave, my holidays, my pace of my work, whatever. And it'll vary from one union to another. So the goal of the American union movement has been to get a better deal when selling their labor power, that is, their workers' capacity to work. The job of the union, in the United States particularly, has been understood. By the way, and not that everybody agreed to this, but the dominant understanding has been the union's job is to negotiate a better deal. Get more pay than you would have gotten if you didn't have a union. Get better working conditions, medical coverage, pension, whatever, than you would have been able to get if you had bargained individually rather than had a union do collective bargaining on your behalf. Okay? And the interesting thing, and to be fair, is that American workers, at least until the 1970s, but for most of the history of the United States as a country, as an independent country, it is a stunning fact, as I've mentioned to you on, our first day in this class, that American workers have in fact enjoyed higher wages. And while there are many reasons for it, one of them is the development in the 19th century of a labor movement towards the end of the century, which worked hard to get higher wages so that the unions have some of the credit for achieving what were pretty unusually high levels of wages for the American worker. And because employers were afraid of having to bargain with unions, they often gave ununionized workers the same wage increases that the unions had won, precisely to prevent their workers from joining a union. You don't need the union. I'm going to give you the higher wage without it. Okay? What about the American left in its organized political party forms, but in all of its many incarnations, community groups, social movements, and so on? I think there you see something very different. In general, sometimes with more and sometimes with less enthusiasm, the American left supported the labor movement, in pushing for higher wages and better working conditions. But the thrust of the left was usually quite different. They supported the labor movement, but they had their own agendas. And those agendas were mostly about power, political power, and social inclusion. What do I mean? Well, the American left has been, for a long time, interested in bringing into the American culture and the American economy people who, for one reason or another, were marginalized, excluded, limited from participation. Poor people who, because of their poverty, couldn't kind of participate in the cultural and political life. Ethnic minorities, religious minorities, immigrants, women. You get the picture. Bring them in. Represent them. Get them to be within the society. Get them the privileges, get them the civil rights and the civil liberties. And so a kind of deal was worked out, if you like, a political deal over a long period of time, in which the labor movement generally supported these inclusionary social movements, and they in return generally supported the labor movement in pushing for higher wages and better working conditions. And this alliance sometimes achieved power. You could make the case, for example, that Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal was based on this coming together and mutual support generating electoral victories. Other times, like today, it looks pretty weak and not so effective. That varied. But there's been this left, and they've worked together more or less. And they've had some successes. As I say, we've had very high wages. And we have been, as societies go, not so bad in integrating minorities and women and so forth into our society better or sooner than many other societies have been able to do. So you could even say there have been notable successes in what both the labor movement and the left have been able to achieve. Not what they hoped for, not what they wanted, and in the last 30 years, particularly unhappy results, but nonetheless, let's give them what they were due. But this alliance with this agenda that I just described to you also had profound political costs associated with it. And it's those I want to focus on more. What were the costs? One key cost, because you're going to see where I take this immediately when we start talking about what a new strategy of labor and the left would be, one of the costs of what happened before that I've just described to you is the following. There was little or no attention to the organization of production, to how the enterprise where you go to work 9 to 5, 5 out of 7 days a week, there was little attention paid to how the organization of work was to be undertaken. That was ignored. It was not considered an appropriate or a possible focus. It was, to make a long story short, left to the powers that be. The capitalists organized the work site and organized the work process. The workers came to work and produced a surplus appropriated by the capitalist. They understood that was their job. They did not understand themselves to have any particular rights to control, let alone transform, that arrangement. What they wanted was to be well paid for what they did. And they wanted good working conditions. But they did not challenge that they were there, that they produced a surplus, the way we went through in when we had our earlier classes. That was, they understood to be what their job was. They went, they produced the work. At the end of the day, they went home. And they left behind for the employer to use and sell as he sees fit the work they produced, the output, their intelligence and their muscles generated. It was a little different in Europe. Europe has a different left tradition from the United States. So for example, if I had the time, which I don't, I would tell you that in Europe, there was a more classic interest in questions that were secondary here in the United States. First, there was a focus on property. European leftists and even the European labor movement favored social property over private property. They liked the idea that the government became a major actor in the economic system, that it took control, ownership of means of production, of enterprises of all kinds. So the issue of private versus social ownership of productive property was a bigger factor and a bigger issue in European left circles, European social democracy, than it was here. That's an important difference. And secondly, the issue of free market, regulated market. In European socialism, the notion that the government can, should get right in there, regulate and control is a much more developed part of left thinking than it is here. Regulation in the United States is suspected by large numbers of working class people as being unnecessary, unhelpful, and probably bad for working people. It's not considered to be the great solution. In moments of great crisis, regulations, like today, are being brought in. But like today, the working class in the United States doesn't miss the fact that the most enthusiastic proponents of government entering the market right now is the capitalist who's leading the charge. Now, the capitalists want them out as soon as the trouble passes, but while there's trouble, in they should come. Okay? So there's something different. But I would argue that in the European, like the United States, again, the focus of labor and the left has been mostly on what in economics we call macro, the big picture, the economy as a whole, the level of wages, the level of regulation, who owns the property, and who's included in the social community, what are the civil liberties. Looking at the organization of production, how production works, who produces a surplus, who gets it, what do they do with it? These were questions that dropped out of the general discourse and the general focus of most elements on the labor and the left. Nor did it make a difference that when Marx's own work enters the picture in the second half of the 19th century and ever since. And even though Marx's work focuses so intensely on explaining where the surplus is and how it's generated and who gets it, all in volume one, and then volumes two and three of Capital, where he begins to look at how that surplus, once it's produced, gets distributed, and how that all shapes. This focus on the production and distribution of surplus, even by the Marxists who studied it, is not brought in to the labor and the left movement. What seems to have happened, as best I can tell, is that the Marxism comes in, but is more shaped by what I just described as the interests of labor and the left than it does shape them. It's one of those many examples where a set of ideas arrives into a milieu that more changes those ideas to fit the milieu than that milieu is changed by the new set of ideas, the new insights. So that Marxism has had to struggle, as it still does, to bring the insights of this analysis of production and surplus to become central parts of what a revolutionary strategy of the labor left movement might be. And in the second half of what I'm going to do today, that's exactly what I'm going to try to do. Take that class analytic and show what kind of political strategy comes out of it. Okay. Why then has the left and labor in the United States, granted its successes, nonetheless been on the whole relatively weak, clearly weaker in most ways than its European counterparts for most of its history over the last 100, 150 years? What's that about? How do we account for the relative weakness of labor in the left, notwithstanding the successes and moments of political strength that it did have? What is that? And I want to make a general argument that will then be the transition from analyzing what was to analyzing a new strategy, because I'm going to try now to explain why the labor and left haven't been a lot more successful in the United States than they have been, and more successful in the way that we would presumably wish they could be. Okay. First, by not challenging the organization of production in the enterprise, what the labor movement and the left effectively did was to support, endorse, leave as is the production, appropriation, and distribution of the surpluses produced in capitalist enterprises, those that Marx called productive enterprises, where the surplus was produced. What does that mean? It means that across the country, in enterprises large and small, in agriculture, in industry, in services, across the board, your organization of production meant groups of workers, 10 here, 10,000 there, came to work and produced commodities that automatically were the property of their employer who sold them. And by selling them, he realized, the employer did, the difference between what it cost him to have them produced and what he got when he sold them. That difference being the surplus. The surplus accrued to the employers. What did the employers do with the surplus? Several things. And I think they explain the weakness of the left. First, when they had to, when there was no option for them, they used a part of the surplus produced by workers to give it back to the workers as higher wages. In other words, to secure the labor supply, they had to rebate to the workers a part of the surplus that the workers delivered to them. Most of the reason this happened in the United States up until 1970s, when it stopped, and it has never resumed since. Remember that key factor we talked about? The real wage of the American worker today on average is about what it was in the late 1970s. So this history of rising wages stopped 30 years ago and has never resumed. But up until then, the major reason capitalists would have to give a portion of the surplus appropriated from their workers back to them as a premium over their wage was because we had a chronic labor shortage in the United States. This had nothing to do with generosity. It had nothing to do with anything other than for an employer to secure a labor force required either inducing waves of immigrants to come to the United States, and that is our history, or to make sure that even if you had a worker, that that worker would not use whatever opportunities arose to leave your job and go and become a farmer on the land that was so plentiful here as we moved west from the East Coast where we began to the West Coast on the other side. So to hold workers once you had them and to bring workers in the numbers you needed them, there had to be a part of the surplus used to provide the rising wages. So that was one way you managed to weaken the left. In a sense, you kept giving workers higher wages over time. I want to remind you the statistic. From 1820 to 1970, the average real wage of the United States workers rises every decade. It's an extraordinary history and helps explain much of what's unique about American capitalism. But capitalists provided that. They got enough surplus from their workers that they could take a portion and give it back and provide higher wages. And the irony was it weakened unions because you got a higher wage without the union. The conditions were such that the union, which kept saying, come here to get higher wages, was always being undercut by the ability to get higher wages without a union. Second, use of the surplus after that. The capitalists used the surplus, this discretionary fund that rolls into their hands because of the structure of production, to make sure that the democratic state, the state that the left gathered more and more people into, the immigrants, the women, and so forth, as we get more and more people in, and there were more and more people in a formally democratic state subject to voting and electoral procedures, the money had to be used to make sure that the people never got control of that government in such a way as to question or challenge the organization of production. So they, to make a long story short, they used the surplus to buy the government, which is why it is always true of the United States to remind everybody, especially those of us who come from other parts of the world, that we have the best government money can buy. Okay? And we do. And the corporate community, the capitalists, have always understood the need to control the political process. And they spend a fortune of money, not just now, not just with big lobbying, not just with campaign contributions, but with 1,000 other mechanisms, all of which are funded by the surpluses they control. Third thing that the capitalists did with their surpluses, they needed to develop, and they understood in the United States very early, we are the country in which advertising as an industry is born and nurtured. It's one of our proudest exports to those of you in the rest of the world who copy us, even if now you teach us new ways of doing it. Nonetheless, it has been understood the importance of shaping the common mind. And corporations have, and capitalists have from a long time, understood that a very important use of the surplus is to develop and to disseminate ideological arguments about how the world works. It is done by corporate campaigns, by public relations, by academic funding. Universities in our country from the beginning have been subject to and dependent upon largesse from receivers of surplus who basically fund these institutions. In recent decades, we've had an addition, think tanks. Agencies who basically take academics, put them in an institution that's separate to generate an endless flow of ideological material to be disseminated through the media and so forth. The political discourse, the media discourse, and the academic discourse have been shaped by the source of the money that makes all of them possible, and that's overwhelmingly from the surplus. One of the effects of that ideological effort is precisely to keep the question of the organization of production off the political agenda. So, for example, in academic language, which is the part of the world I come from, the way this was done was to develop a discourse, now a good 200 years old, a discourse that works ceaselessly to establish the idea that capitalism as a system of organizing production with private property and markets is the most efficient, technically superb engine of prosperity, efficiency, and freedom. It's spectacular. I mean, an effort that understood the need to so establish these ideas that anyone who even opened the question would appear to be a lunatic, someone with either an ignorance beyond words or some devious other motive to make them say something so patently absurd. The very idea of efficiency is the center of this. And it's an idea which, if you'll allow me 2 minutes, you ought to have at the back of your mind as a fundamental question, not an assumption. The concept of efficiency works like this. Any event has, the idea goes, a series of consequences. Any event. If you raise an interest rate, if you change a price, if you hire a worker, if you build a factory, whatever the event, has a chain of consequences, the argument goes. Some of those consequences are good. Those are called benefits from the event. Some of the consequences that flow from the event are argued to be costs. Okay, with this idea, which is as complicated as making oatmeal in the morning, with this idea, efficiency is calculated as follows. You measure the consequences that are good from an event, the benefits, and then you measure the consequences that flow from this event that are bad, the costs. Here comes the fun part. If the added number of benefits exceeds the added number of costs, you've got an efficient activity. It is a net benefit for us as a community. Isn't that nice? And then, of course, you can compare two events. Event A, costs and benefits. Event B, costs and benefits. And if the difference between the benefits and the events of action A is bigger than action B, don't do B, do A. What's the problem with this idea? Well, I'm going to just put on a different hat. I'm normally an economist, but for a moment I'm going to become a mathematician. Mathematically, what I just said is absurd. And let me show you why. One, how many consequences flow from any event? Answer, you have no idea. It's infinite. It's not only infinite in number, it's infinite in time. You don't know what the consequences are. Some of them won't happen for 10 years. Some of them will happen in a place you didn't look. Nobody knows what all the consequences of any event are. You already know that from your personal life. You say something to somebody, it has a consequence you didn't foresee. Try as you may, this is going to happen to you all your life. We don't understand each other the same way. We don't understand the same words the same way. Consequences are always surprising. So the notion that we can have someone who measured all the consequences is absurd, because if there are infinite consequences of anything, infinity, that's the concept in mathematics, means you can't measure it. That's really all it means. But it's worse. It's worse. Let's go back. What did I say? I said an event has consequences, and you measure the good ones and the bad ones. Here's your problem, friends. The consequences of an event are always the consequences of other events as well. You can't do that. You can't say X happened, then Y happened, and Y happened because X did. Mm-mm. You can't know that. Y happened because lots of things did. There's no way to allocate the effect X from the cause Y because too many other things are going on. How many other things are going on? An infinity of other things are going on. You'd have to know what all of their impacts were on the thing you're measuring in order to be able to isolate the effect of what you're measuring. You can't do that. The idea of efficiency is a mirage. It doesn't exist. It's a mathematical zero set. There's nothing in it. The only interesting question is how an idea like that could become the measuring rod for everything and anything, including, for example, the efficiency of Soviet planning on the one hand, as opposed to free market. What? What? What are you doing? That's nonsense. It is mathematical zilch. So the only interesting thing is, why is it there? In a few decades, people will look back on discussions of efficiency the way we now look back on those disputes in the Middle Ages between great leaders of the Roman Catholic Church when they had debates, which they did, about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. We giggle. We'll giggle about the efficiency discussion too. The one is exactly as reasonable as the other. But the idea was brilliant. Why? Because instead of understanding the world as a place of struggle, where we want these things to happen and those people want those things to happen, and we kind of deal with why we have these differences and what's at stake in our struggle. We get rid of all of that. We resolve the struggle by measuring in a way that everybody has to bend down to the efficiency of something. So we should all support X because it's the most efficient way to go. Efficiency is a method of browbeating your political and ideological adversary into believing that there is a final resolution to your debate, an absolute truth that all of your disagreements have to bow down to. In the courts of the United States, there are constant struggles between different sides, each of which brings their expert to show that the efficiency argument favors them. On both sides, it has exactly the same function as the armies that clash at night, each one sure of victory because God is on their side. Efficiency and God are different only in the letters that go into spelling them. It's the same game. It's just a secular form. Anyway, an ideological effort funded by the surplus was produced to make the organization of production a technical matter of maximum efficiency. The capitalist enterprise is then an engine of efficiency that overwhelms all alternatives. That's the function of the idea. Okay. In this story, please notice an implication, and here it is. We don't need a conspiracy theory. That no conspiracy defeated the labor and the left movement in the United States. The beauty of what the analysis is I just gave you is that the appropriators of surplus, the capitalists, they're scattered everywhere. You don't need a conspiracy. In the little town, in the pizza shop, in the little workshop, in the factory, in the big corporation in Manhattan, wherever you go, there they are. The capitalists appropriating the surpluses from their workers and using them in the way that is appropriate to secure their situation, to grow their companies. And how do they do that? By paying workers so they keep getting more surplus from them. By making sure the political situation favors them, doesn't provide obstacles to them. And by making sure that ideological communities' ways of thinking facilitate their solving of their problems. You don't need a conspiracy. The beauty of capitalism is it decentralizes and disperses the surpluses all over so that big and little capitalists can get together with problems and disagreements to work out a general way to use the surplus to support and develop capitalism, which is what they have done. What are the resources of labor and the left compared to this? Answer, there aren't any. What workers do with their wages is secure their own lives, pay for their own food, pay for their clothing, pay for their shelter, have some entertainment, raise their families. But they don't dispose of a surplus. The surplus that gets produced is precisely what they don't have. And so they can only support their efforts to shape a public consciousness, to influence politics, by taking money out of their wages and using them for that. And the amount that they can do that is always constricted and constrained. So they're not in a position to fight. This is not a level playing field. Friends, to use an American idiom. This is not a level playing field. Okay, what then would I argue is a strategy for labor and the left that, and I'm going to push the point now, is the only way I can see a way forward. And it goes to the heart of everything I've been saying. Labor and the left must begin to deal with, to recognize the organization of production as an issue, as a problem. They have to be able to see, as I've tried to show you, that by not dealing with it, by not making it a contention, by not challenging and changing it, They have basically created their own enemy and the resources that enemy uses to defeat them. They keep delivering surplus, the workers do, to the people who use it to thwart the interests of the workers. And it's worked. Therefore, the lesson would be, it's got to stop. What does that mean? You must, if you have a hope to move the society in a leftward direction, whether that be economically, politically, culturally, you have to do something to shift the surplus from the hands of those who use it to defeat you into your own hands so that you can defeat them. And if you don't do that, you will have the next 100 years look a lot like the last 100. You have to say, and here's the lesson of Marx. That's why he's interesting. Marx says there is a surplus, and here's who produces it, and here's who gets it. All I've done is point out to you what the people who get it use it for. And one of those things is to weaken and undercut the interests and goals of labor and the left. If labor and the left were able to change this, it would be the strongest possible blow they could to the resources being used now to forward and secure an anti-labor and anti-left agenda. It would move those resources into the hands of labor and the left, the majority of people. What would do that? If the majority of people could in some way get their hands on the surplus rather than it being appropriated by those who appropriate it now and who have been showing us how they use it and toward what ends they use it. So how would I do this? How could we operationalize, concretize the implications of this class analysis of production and its impact on labor and the left? And the answer here is really very simple, and we've already encountered it in this series of classes. You need to change the organization of production. It begins this way. In every enterprise, the workers who come to work and do the work are going to become themselves their own board of directors. You're not going to have the relationship between the workers who produce a surplus and a different group of people who get it and use it to reproduce this situation. That's the issue. And you can use a lot of different phrases to make this issue clear, some of which come out of American history. Being your own boss, something which a majority of Americans say they would like. They want that. I'd like to be my own boss. Well, I've just articulated a plan that is the closest you're ever going to get as an average American worker to such a situation. That is, if your enterprise were converted into one in which you as a worker become part of the collective board of directors. That's your best shot. Number two, there is a long history of a kind of enterprise that Americans have been fascinated by, as have others. These are called co-ops, cooperatives. There's a lot in that movement that could be appropriated for this one. Arguments about the benefits of cooperative enterprise, of cooperative work, of cooperative living. That's another root, if you like, another tradition that could be brought in here. But the one I want to stress is this one that I've developed today. That the only way that you're going to change the outcome of the long relative weakness of labor in the left in the United States is if the people who are suffering from that stop delivering surplus into the hands of the people who make them suffer like that. We are funding the institution that thwarts what we try to achieve in life. And that's not very smart. That has to be addressed. Otherwise, what? Let's go through it. we'll find a candidate or even a political party, and we'll work very hard and we'll get them in. But once they're in, they're subject to all of the pressures that come from all of the surpluses that all of the capitalists use to sway, to bend, to block what's going to happen. And they become frustrated and they disappoint us. Another example. We pass a regulation to prevent some bad thing. We've already talked about that. Then the people with the surplus go to work to get around the regulation, to evade it, to weaken it, to repeal it. And they do that. One of the reasons the collapse in 2007 happened in the United States was that 50 regulations passed after the last great capitalist collapse in the 1930s. 50 of those regulations between the end of the 1930s and 2007 were evaded, weakened, or repealed. And that's the story over and over again. We have delivered the surplus into the hands of those who will block the regulations as long as they can, and if they can't succeed at that, will then evade them, weaken them, undermine them. And we sit there waiting for which one is going to happen in what order this time. We're not dealing with the root of the problem. And the root of the problem is a structure that delivers surplus into the hands of people who use it in the way we have been living with. Is that all that has to be done? I don't think so. I think, in fact, if you let yourself think about the social and political implications of workers becoming their own board of directors, of production being reorganized, so it is no longer a conflictual relationship between employer and employee because the same people are occupying both of those positions, I think you'll see where this might go. But let me help you. We have a democracy, we say, in our residences. That is, we have a procedure of voting where we live. You vote where you live. You vote together with other people who live near you for representatives of geographic areas, a ward in a city, a county, a city, a state, a region. And we allow for a certain amount of election to happen where you choose your representatives. But the problem is this, let's call it political democracy, based on residence, where you live, has always been, here we go again, undercut by the absence of any parallel economic democracy. In other words, being able to control your life where you work as well as where you live. My proposal solves that problem. It creates a parallel democratic organization of production. And that's not only good in terms of what it'll do about the surplus, it's also good because it will create the basis for the democracy in the residential area to no longer just be formal, but to become real. Why? Because the workers who live are the same people as the workers who work. And because the workers who work will be controlling the surplus, they will not allow it to be used to undercut the neighborhood where they live, since that would be self-destructive, and people are not normally like that. So whereas, to give you an example, whereas a capitalist enterprise might be willing to beef up profits by using a chemical that pollutes the neighborhood where the capitalists don't live, the workers are unlikely to do it. Unlikely to do it. Impossible that they'll do it? No. I'm not coming up with something that solves all human problems. I'm not an idiot. But it's a movement in a direction that's long overdue and that does solve some very real problems. I mentioned to you before that the wages of workers stopped rising in the 1970s. Why? Let's go over it. What happened? Again, four things. We had a technological innovation called the computer that substituted machines for people on a massive scale. It reduced the demand for labor. Number two, American employers left the United States in record numbers starting in the 1970s, moving production outside the United States. That reduced the demand for labor in the United States. two major reductions in the demand for labor, but we're not done. At the same time, there were two increases in the supply of people looking for work. Women in America changed. Millions of women stopped being at home and decided they wanted part-time or full-time jobs just like their husbands. And they moved en masse, partly through the women's liberation movement, partly through many mechanisms in the labor force, looking for work. And we had more waves of immigration, particularly from Latin America and secondarily from Asia, into the United States. So we had immigrants and women looking for work when there were fewer jobs available. Wages stopped rising and have never resumed. Why? Because a capitalist confronted with a labor market where he doesn't have to raise the wages the way he used to won't do it, and they didn't do it. If workers had run the factories themselves, would they have likely stopped raising their wages? Answer, no. We know productivity kept going up in the last 30 years. So the wherewithal, to the wealth with which to pay higher wages was there. Capitalists didn't use it. We know what they used it for. Starting in the 1970s, they boosted the pay of top managers on a scale we've never seen before. Bonuses, you all read about it. They also used that money not only to pay a tiny number of people a vast amount of money, producing an inequality of wealth in the United States that is stunning to look at. That workers in charge of factories would never have done that. Second thing, they used the money to facilitate the export of jobs. American workers would have been highly unlikely to do that. You get the picture? History would have been different. There would have been other problems, surely. But we would have changed our past history in ways that labor and the left wanted and needs. But it would have taken the steps to remove that surplus from being delivered to the people who stopped raising the wages, who moved production out of the country, who substituted for the workers freaked out by the end of rising wages, the mountain of lending to them, which was done with that surplus instead. The combination of the wealth at the one end and the growing indebtedness of the mass of the people on the other, that's what produced the crisis we're now in. That crisis, too, flows out of the structure of capitalist enterprise. And if labor and the left are suffering from that crisis, 15 million unemployed people, 300,000 foreclosures procedures in court a month now, that also is a result that can't please labor and the left and flows again from this same thing. So the central concept I would offer as a new focal strategy for labor and the left is that the organization of production must be on the agenda of social change, and that labor and the left ought to take the position that in the interests of the mass of people, in the interests of democracy becoming real and not just formal, we have to change the organization of production from the way it has been, employer-employee, capitalist-proletarian, to the self-organization, if you like, of workers who become the appropriators collectively of the surplus they have collectively produced in enterprises large and small. And the slogan that would be needed to cover this is simple. We can do better than capitalism. You can become your own boss if we do better than capitalism. It flows, and it's long overdue. The refusal to question and attack and demand the transformation of the organization of production was something the left and labor should never have done. I can close by tying us back with the first class. If you recall, I told you a story about Marx's class analytics. And I told it to you in terms of a little bit of biography of old Karl. Right? He's born in 1818. The great earth-shaking event that all young intellectuals in Europe were completely taken over by at that time was the French Revolution of 1789. It had transformed Europe from the old feudal system that had existed for 1,000 years and ushered in a new world. The slogans of the French Revolution, which reverberated around Europe from 1789 for 100 years, liberty, equality, fraternity. Marx was taken with all of that, as were all the other young left people that were emerging in those years. By the time Marx reaches his maturity, 1840s, right? He's born in 1818, becomes a young man, finishes his education. He's confronted with a fundamental reality, as are all the other leftists. Whatever happened out of the French Revolution, whatever transformations, the end of feudalism, the arrival of modern cities, the arrival of modern industry, the arrival of modern capitalism. When he looked around Germany, which where he was born, and then England, where he spent the rest of his life, one thing he was clear on, he didn't see liberty, equality, and fraternity. He lived in London at the time of Charles Dickens. If you ever remember reading Oliver Twist, that's what he saw. That's what he lived. Or Emile Zola in France. Same thing. So he had to face the fact that something was wrong here. Whatever the French Revolution achieved, it didn't achieve what it said it was after. Liberty, equality, fraternity. It didn't overcome inequality, it made it worse. It didn't overcome elite control of social life, it just changed who the elite were. It didn't liberate the mass of workers from serfdom and slavery, it made them wage slaves instead. So he had to ask himself, what went wrong? And his answer, 3 volumes of Capital, 3 volumes of the theories of surplus value, was we, the leftists, the people who made the French Revolution, Robespierre, Danton, all of them, up to him, we didn't see things that had to be changed. We didn't change them, and not changing them undid our project, made us fail. We got to do better next time. We have to figure out what was wrong with what happened in the French Revolution that explains why it didn't work, so that the next time the masses move, they won't make that mistake again. So he uses his exile in London to go to the British Museum and study. And what he decides is it's about the organization, here we go now, of production. It's about how in the organization of production there's a surplus produced by some people that other people get and use to maintain this arrangement, and that has all kinds of social consequences. And he gives us examples. He shows us, for example, how this arrangement of production produces a god-awful life for people. That's in the long section of Volume 1 called The Length of the Working Day. A long discussion about how workers, Oliver Twist in England, 16-hour days. Why is that? What is that about? He shows us why that happens. He shows us that you have this kind of capitalism, it has that consequence. He does there what I just did again. I'm just copying him. I'm showing you how the organization of production in a factory, the surplus, produces a politics that labor and the left loses over and over again. So if you're going to change that outcome, if you're going to have a new, different strategy for the 21st century that is different from the 20th, you have to recognize both what you achieved in the 20th and in the 19th and 20th. Remember, I started today by saying there were some gains, there were some achievements. But more important is you got to look at what didn't work out. And the irony is, here we are, right, 150 years, roughly, since Marx died. And we're still needing people to recognize there's something that this man figured out that we need to understand and use if we're not going to continue to fail. The reason I got interested in Marx is not because he's a nice man or that he's a leftist or that he's romantic. He analyzes, he solves a problem. He's that wonderful character who, having struggled with many of the problems we're facing, figured something out that we can make use of. To not make use of it, to not use his analysis, that's like saying, I'm not going to use fire. Huh? It makes you warm when it's cold. It cooks your food. Use it. Why would the left not make use of this apparatus of insight? That's bad. But to be proud that you don't know and use Marxism? That's beyond words. And most of the American left, including those carrying the name Marxist, never seriously undertook to learn this stuff. It's extraordinary. And what you'd learn if you did it is there's some really useful clues about what we need to do to change the situation. Class analysis, and by that again I mean analyzing the organization of the surplus, not who's got a lot of money, who's got not, who's got a lot of power, who's got that. That's interesting. That's not what Marx contributed, and that's not what's missing. We all are sensitive to who has a lot of money and who doesn't, and who has a lot of power and who doesn't. What we have not understood is the relevance, the applicability, the urgency of understanding and changing the organization of surplus in our culture, which is the topic of Marx's mature work. So I've ended this way, trying to make the best case I can for why practical people wanting to make a practical difference in changing modern capitalism have an urgent need to come to terms with, to learn about, and to learn how to use class analysis is the best chance we have to change the world and to change this society. Thank you very much for all your time and for coming, and I hope you found it useful. Good. Okay, yeah, let's do some. Let's have some questions because we didn't have it before. Yes, sir?
Yeah, one question. If you read like Hart and McGee, they talk about immaterial goods and immaterial production. And I'm just wondering, in your analysis, how, and even they say in places that Marx has been here, has tread this ground before, some extent, but how do you, it's so disparate with the mobility of workers, part-time workers, workers at home, not even any fucking factories, and they're not going to the factory every day. How do they organize, you know, how do you have the Zapatistas over here, the CNT over here, and the SNT in Brazil, all these disparate movements, and you have migrant immigrants, the poorest boarded back and forth, and they're trying to close them off, but anyway, how the hell do you get, and then, you know, I'm sort of stuttering here, but you have this movement, this mobility, and then you have the immaterial goods of, like, communications, linguistics, information, the social production going on informally and appropriated, constantly being appropriated by capital. How does this... Let me respond.
And I'm gonna be blunt. I don't mean to be disrespectful. I know Hart very well. I don't know Negri, but I know Hart. But there is a, how to put it, there is a long-standing tendency on the left and in other parts, on the right too, to kind of fetishize every new wrinkle in an economic system. It's absolutely true. We're constantly changing technology, new ways of producing or develop, new ways of transportation, new ways of communication. So is it true to say things are different today than they were 50 years ago or 20 years ago or 100? That's always true. But it's really not the issue. I'm going to be blunt. I don't think anything has changed. That is, the details have. You don't eat your dinner today the way you did 20 years ago. The frequency of eating this and as opposed to that. 20 years ago, you probably were comfortable about eating a hot dog. Today, you're wondering what portion of an unspeakable animal is in there, so you're concerned about it. So things are always changing. But I want to assure you, immaterial production was true in Marx's life, too. That's why he talked about it. The forms have changed, some of the details have changed. But in the reality of the production and distribution of surplus, I'm going to push it. Nothing has changed. We haven't changed that. We could change it, but we haven't changed it. That's what makes Marx's analysis so relevant. And let me pull it on you, you know, play with you just a little bit. I'm a teacher. I watch your faces as I stand here. I can tell. I've been doing this all my life. If I'm not firing on all cylinders, then I see you looking at your watch, looking at the sky, wondering when you're going to get that coffee or that beer or whatever. I know. I've been there myself. I understand. You're bored. I'm not doing my job. I'm not making it riveting the way I try. Right? And believe me, I go home, I feel like crap. I haven't succeeded. So I know you've been paying attention. Even some of you that got a little tired here because it's warm, I understand all that. I can't join you because I'm the one speaking, so I can't play that game. At least it would look funny. So I can tell that you're somehow taken with this. But what I'm doing is a very mechanical application, childish in its simplicity, of what I get from Marx. You may think, what a clever idea. I wish I could claim it. I really do. It would make me feel great. I figured this out. I didn't. I took the Marx and I present a pablum. It's like reading a recipe 10 times and then going and putting together flour and eggs and making the cupcake. If the people around you say, fantastic, you invented a cupcake. You know, if you're an asshole, you'd say, yes, I did. But if you're an honest person, you'd say, I read it over here. It took me 10 minutes to read this. I put it there. You know, that's what I'm following the recipe. That's all I'm doing. It's new. It's interesting. It's dynamic. It opens space up. That's because it's about something that hasn't changed, that has been oppressing us for a long time. And true, the modalities of it. But you know, migrants have been moving for a very long time. The mobility of labor is a very old problem. And by the way, this country is unthinkable. That's all it is. You know, we come here, a group of migrants come here, they kill everybody who's here, virtually, and then they make room for an endless wave of migrants. The city of New York's like a joke. It's just an endless change of the communities that come in. You go to Astoria, and now it's full of Greek people, and these people, and before it was full of these, and then the history of every community is the waves of immigrants that pass through it. So, but it's not new. New York City was a city of immigrants 100 years ago. It's only the identity of the immigrants that has changed. They come from different parts of the world. They have somewhat different cultures and religions and all that. And that's important, but mobility isn't new. Workers' mobility is a very old problem. And it always has had the same reason. People don't undertake mobility because it's a trauma. Both my parents were born in Europe, so I am the child. I was born in the United States, but I can tell you for sure, I am the child of people whose whole lives, including mine as a child, were traumatized by the experience of being an immigrant. They didn't want my mother was born in Germany, my father in France. Okay? They didn't want to come here. They had no interest in this. They were pushed, literally, for their lives out of Europe. So they had to go someplace. They came here. Could have gone somewhere else. They came here. Okay, so people who are mobile are either pulled because they're desperate or pushed because their lives are hanging in the balance. Usually you don't go unless one of those things is very powerful. Sometimes both of them, then you go quickly. Okay. But that's very old. One of the reasons when I hear, and if this offends some of you, so be it, I don't, and it's not my intent. But one of the things I find so funny is when people start talking about the basic culture of our part of the world. Huh? Do a little history. You'll discover that the old culture of your part of the world is crisscrossed with immigration from all over the place. You aren't, because wherever you are has been crisscrossed by people who are all over the place. Your genuine culture isn't. That's not an option for anybody. Maybe in some corner of Greenland that might be true. But for the vast majority of us on the great land masses of the seven continents, the history is completely, you know, all over the place. All over the place. And I think that the reason I stress it is Hart and Negri, in much of what they do, want to hinge a project, an intellectual project, on this evidence of the newness of something. You know, their most famous book is called Empire. And there, they developed an analysis. So we don't have particular imperial countries like we used to. We have one kind of global empire system of things. Well, A, there's nothing new about that at all. That's self-promotion. But here's the interesting thing they did where I get angry. And because we don't have the old capitalists and the imperialists the way we used to, we have a new empire, we need a new concept of the mass of people that are hurt by an empire. And then they invent this word, multitude. I don't know if you've read it, the multitude. And we have to deal with the multitude that are the enemies of the empire. This is like a Star Wars scenario, which is probably an influence here. But here I got angry. Marx went to enormous efforts to break down the notion of the people because he thought it was an abstraction that didn't help us understand things we needed to understand. He broke down the people into those who produce the surplus and those who appropriate. He broke it down and he used a subgroup called class and conflicts of class to go back from class to the multitude, which is very close to the people, is a theoretical retreat from Marx, undertaken by two seriously committed Marxists. They both are. Negri has been in jail much of his life because of his Marxism. So, I mean, these are people who I don't question, but what they're doing is not understand, in my humble opinion, which, as you can see, is not humble, but in my opinion, they have lost what it was that Marx tried to teach us. And by the way, that's not unusual, right? Someone comes along, figures something out. It takes a long time often for that to settle into people's mind. They don't give up the older ways of thinking. They're deeply rooted. People had been thinking about class in terms of who has money and who doesn't, the rich and the poor, the powerful and the powerful. They've been doing that for thousands of years. Along comes Marx and says, there's another thing going on here, and he uses the word class for it, and people say, no, no, I want that old one. Or worse, they think he's repeating the old one because they don't want to have to deal with the trouble of a new one, because that's troubling, a new idea. You feel kind of you've lost out the investment you made in the old one and all the rest. But I think that I find myself 100 and whatever it is, 130 years after Marx's death, I, to be honest, much of what I do is to take what Marx wrote and to present it to people again. You know, I wish I didn't have to. I'd like to spend time taking it further, doing things with it. And I do some of that. But a lot of my effort, including much of it in this class, is to basically say, hey, there's a stunning set of ideas out here, really interesting, and help us understand and change the world. Go taste it. It's like a new flavor of ice cream. Don't miss this. This is... And so it's a little awkward, but that's what I'm doing. And I'm not much taken, honestly, with the people who keep going away from these ideas and justifying it on the grounds, there's new things, there are always new things. I don't think there's anything new in the structure of the organization of production. I think the argument about the surplus is an unbelievable insight into how our societies are organized at the base, where everything gets made, and that's crucial to understand, and we are at the early stages of getting people in some mass way to come to terms with it. And the parallel, I've used it, some of you know before, it's a little bit the parallel with Freudian understanding of the unconscious or the subconscious, right? An awful lot of people in the world still think that the occasional dream they remember having has something to do with having eaten a bad piece of pizza last night. They do not think of it as an entire another part of their brain working, which, if they pay attention to it, will teach them about some of their biggest problems. They don't get it. And you feel tragic having to say to them, you know, your dream isn't about the pizza. It's about things you need and want that you don't know how to proceed, that you think are inappropriate for you to think. So you plug them into another part of the brain because you feel them and you think them, but there's a taboo against acknowledging that you do. So you stick it in a special place of your brain, but it doesn't just sit there. It functions. When you see somebody, not just your conscious mind says, oh, that's Marianne, but the unconscious, that's the one I wish I could, dot, 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 right? Because you can't. But all of those things, and you will discover, if you haven't already, that you can figure out and solve some of the most painful personal dilemmas of your life if you use this apparatus, if you ask these questions, if you, I don't know how many of you know this, but if you go to a shrink, you write down your drink. Try to keep a pad by the bed. And if you wake up at night because you have to pee, you'll get a drink of water, and the dream is in your mind, write it down. And look at it again in the morning. You're going to learn things about yourself. And they're very important. But you know, you feel tragic if you sit down with an audience all over the world and you begin to talk about dreams and you realize you're back in 1896. That's when Sigmund Freud wrote the book, The Interpretation of Dreams, where he lays all this out. And we have an enormous apparatus of psychotherapy and psychology and so a lot of people that are learning and still the majority of people on this planet have no clue about any of this. And so we have Marxist parties and Marxist organizations and Marxist trade unions and Marxist journals and Marxist, and how many people understand what we're doing here? Yeah.
I took this class because I was more interested in, I haven't been really introduced to a lot of Marxism, so some friends of mine and I, we've been talking a lot about debt and finance capitalism, and so my kind of assignment for our little group, I came to this because I wanted to know more about Marxism, see if there's something I could bring to this discussion, which is still, we're just talking about ideas and different ways for people to resist debt. Is there anything, that's why I'm asking the question now, is there anything from, I have an awesome understanding of surplus now, which is great, and has changed the way I've thought about a lot of things, and I've been talking about it in many ways, but for political strategies about debt resistance, is there anything that you might want to say, or that, because for me, it doesn't seem like there's anything in Marxism, or in Marx's writing about that at all, actually, but.
There is. There is. If you, for the first thing I would say to you is, if you go to volume 3 of Capital, and don't be intimidated, you know, it's just a book. And parts of it will be opaque and difficult, and other parts will be fun to read. He's a good writer, a big sense of humor, lots of irony and sarcasm. It's fun. In volume 3, there's a whole huge section. I mean, I don't know, 200 pages. I mean, I don't know exactly, but a lot on what's called money lending capital. That is debt. That's what it's about. Who are these capitalists? Why do they lend money? To whom do they lend money? And how is the lending of money related to the production and distribution of surplus? That's what he does. So, and he talks there about interest rates and what determines them and how they change. So, first thing, just to correct you, there's an enormous body of work by Marx on credit, debt, lending, all of that. Number one. Number two, since Marx, there have been a whole host of Marxist theorists who've written down and extended all kinds of studies based on Marx's work, looking at finances and industry as banking and so on. Give you a couple of references if you obviously email me, I'll give you plenty more. But perhaps the most famous was a book written in 1910, right? Marx dies in 1883, so we're talking 30 years later, 1910, an Austrian Marxist named Rudolf Hilferding, H-I-L-F-E-R-D-I-N-G, Rudolf Hilferding, writes a book called, in German, Das Finanzkapital, Finance Capital, available, by the way, in English, I think MIT Press or something. It's available. You go on to Google or something, or Amazon, you get it. In a way, that was the great breakthrough of the first Marxist to really focus. He's an economist, this Hilferding. By the way, he was a minister in the Austrian government. He was a social democratic Marxist theorist. He moved kind of to the right, became kind of a conventional socialist, not a Marxist so much, later in his life. I believe he was killed by Hitler. He lived until Hitler came. But anyway, he wrote this book in 1910. That was the first, and that spawned then over the last, 100 years now since his book, all kinds of work by Marxists on all kinds of levels of debt. There's no end. There's lots and lots of material, number one. Marx was most interested, however, in a kind of debt that you may not be interested in, and that is commercial debt. Industrial debt, the debt where a bank, for example, lends to a corporation. Secondarily, much less interested he was in when banks lend to governments, national debt. What was not a big deal at the time he was writing and therefore didn't get a lot of his attention was what we now call consumer debt, the debt given to workers. And to tell you the truth, consumer debt is a very new phenomena. It hasn't, in many parts of the world, it still doesn't exist. Or if it exists, it exists at the absolute micro level. It exists in the sense that the bartender lets you run a tab over a period of time. That's like a loan, but it's that kind of thing. But general lending to the working class is really very new. The pioneer in that is the United States with home loans, mortgages.
There's a guy I don't know his name right off the top of my head in Barcelona. And what he does as an example of the expropriation of surplus over a 5-year period, he wound up taking in different kind of loans and things over 500,000 euro, and used the 500,000 euro to fund different other leftist and he was in the anarchist in Barcelona project. And then finally, when he ran it to as far as he could run it, then he came out publicly and said, I took the 500,000 euro, and I'm not going to pay any of it back because the whole thing.
Right.
And that was just an interesting. So far, he can't leave Spain now. They don't really know what to do with him, and they don't know what to do with a bunch of other people.
Well,
millions of people stop paying.
Right, and there are millions of people in the United States, probably millions of people now who are basically doing the same thing, who use their mortgages. It's called equity loans. You take out of your house, the part that you own, and you keep borrowing against it until there's no more left, and then you use it for everything else, and then you tell the mortgage company you can't pay, and that's part of what brought the crisis on now, that we have a working class that can't pay anymore. It's indebted up. But I think you could find, with a little effort, you could do it yourself. In other words, you could ask yourself, okay, let me trace through the production distribution of surplus the way we've been doing, and now let me ask, what would make a worker borrow? What would make a capitalist lend? What would be the effects on the worker of having a debt, on the capitalist of being a creditor? How? And that's what has to be done. And my guess is that if you did it, you'd come up with a very interesting and different understanding of the whole debt issue than you would get if you don't use that theory. And that's the point. That is the point. I'm on the editorial board of a journal called Rethinking Marxism. I don't know if any of you have ever seen it, but it's been around now for 20 some years. It comes out quarterly. And I can assure you, if you did an interesting paper on the relation of surplus to debt, we'd publish it. That's our job. And there are people doing this kind of stuff all over the place, absolutely. Because consumer debt is a relatively new phenomenon. In many parts of the world, it's really new. That is, I'll give you an example. 20 years ago, nobody in South Korea had a credit card. Today, the average South Korean is more indebted on their credit card than the average American. They went completely crazy. The British today have a higher level of consumer debt than the United States does. You know, 20 years ago, the British, like most Europeans, didn't do it. The Germans have no debt at all, hardly. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but hardly any. The German people, they don't want this. They don't mortgage their houses the way we do. They don't take credit card loans the way we do. They just don't do it.
Why do you think that is? Is that because they've seen inflation and they've seen things like that?
I think in the last 75 years, they have been, or the last 100 years, let's say, come on, you know, they have been traumatized and they have lost everything and they have no confidence at all. In 19, you know, first they lost two world wars. It's heavy, you know. I'm not excusing them. I don't want you to bleed for the poor German people, but I mean, to lose two world wars is a bad trip. Between the two wars, they had the worst inflation in the very modern capitalist country in the world, 1922, 1923. Their currency went to nothing. In 1921, it took four, they were called Deutschmark at that time, German currency, four Deutschmark to the dollar. By the end of 1923, there were 6 billion German Deutschmark to the dollar. That's an inflation. My mother, who lived in Berlin during this inflation, told me the stories that her father, that's my grandfather, would get paid. He worked in a department store. He would get paid his salary twice a day. So at lunch, he would get a paper bag filled with notes, bills, paper money, and he would run. He didn't take before this happened, he would take his lunch in a bag to work with him, and they would eat it, you know, in the middle of the day, like everybody else. Germans are very frugal, so you say you don't eat in a restaurant. That's crazy because it's too expensive. So anyway, my grandmother would give him his lunch, but during the inflation time, he would run home, have his lunch at home, because he would, like a relay runner, he would hand the bag at noon of his pay to his wife, my grandmother, who would immediately take out, like a bat out of hell, to the store to spend it. Because if she didn't, if she waited 3 hours, it would be worthless. The prices would have gone up so much that paper bag would have gotten her, you know, a piece of candy instead of a pound of sugar and a pound of flour and a quart of milk and whatever she had. So he got paid twice a day and had to spend it as fast as he got it. But the trauma for the Germans was, having spent the previous century as a frugal, you know, the image of German, every family saved money. Saving money was the kind of virtue you may remember your grandmother telling you when you were a little kid about how it's good to put some money aside. Don't go blow it all on candy or whatever else you were doing. And so the Germans are extreme version of that. So they had all saved money. And in the period of 3-4 weeks, it was worthless. It couldn't buy them a quart of butter. And these people, having just lost World War I, which was the most devastating for human life of all wars so far, so their country had been devastated, and now their nest egg that they hoped would get them through the grim gone. So for them, finance, big business, is so suspect, so corrupt, they're not going to give their money to anybody. They're going to, you know, they're not going to go into debt. They're not going to do that. Just not going to do that. And so you see, Germany has nothing like our foreclosure panic in this country. They don't have anything like that. They didn't borrow like that. They didn't use their houses as cash machines to get money. They didn't do any of that. And they're not suffering the way we are. That's a very important thing for you to know, in large part because the media here need to not let you know this. Everybody's suffering. The president said, the whole world, we are suffering in very particular ways that other countries are not suffering. And that has to do with, but you know, I'm not saying the Germans are good, we're stupid or something. Our history is different. We used to be a society that did save a lot of money. That stopped in the 1970s. Americans committed to rising standard of living. The wages don't do it anymore. You eat up your savings. And when that's done, you use the credit card. And then you can ask the question, which is the big question now. How in the world do you get out of this crisis? Workers cannot work more. We work more hours than any other workers in the world. And they can't borrow anymore because nobody will lend to an American worker because he can't pay back. So there's no way for the consumption to resume. Everything Obama is doing, we're going to get the economy going again. How? It can't. It can't go up. There's no basis for it. And so the world, the finances around the world, of course the banks aren't lending. They know what I just said. They know it better than me. They're not going to do it. It's too uncertain, everything. This is not your run-of-the-mill downturn that's going to be followed by an upturn, then we all go to the beach. This is the result of a 30, 40-year buildup on top of a 150-year history. This is not going away anytime soon. Yeah?
Could you comment on the German system of workers on boards?
Yes, the Germans have two things we do not have in the United States that are interesting. And if you're interested, I have this blog on my website, for those of you who don't know, and I write stuff there every few days. And one of the things I recently wrote is about this German system. So it's a bit, it's not that long, you know, 6 or 7 paragraphs, but it's better than what I can say now. They have two things under German law. German workers, if you have an enterprise with more than 2,000 people, the workers have to have 50% of the members of the board of directors. Very important you understand that. And 50% of the work of the board, I think it's 50%. I may have it, it may be a different percentage, but they have to be represented on the board of directors. And they have in every workplace, more than I think 10 workers, something called a works council. It is not a trade union. It is a council of the workers. They elect people, like a Soviet, yes, they elect people, and they have real powers. Things that the company wants to do, they have to sign off on. The management, for example, cannot close the factory and move somewhere else. They have to get the approval of the works council. So yes, these are the results of a stronger leftist movement that existed years ago and pushed all these things through. Now, they're trying to weaken them. There are ways for the capitalists to get around them. They are limited in what they can do. But compared to the United States, there are laws. The law in Germany says you cannot close a factory. If you don't give a year's notice, if you're a factory, you're going to move, you're going to leave Germany to go to another part of Germany or to go out of Germany, you have to give a year's notice. Why? Because you've got to give the community and the workers the time to adjust their lives, to find another job, to find another source of tax, or whatever the problem is. Of course, the companies hate that. Because if you tell workers we're leaving in a year, you're giving them a big incentive to go find a job somewhere else and not wait for a year. So it's a burden on the corporation. They hate it. They have not been able to change it. It's been there for decades. So they have to get the local community's approval. They have to get the works council approval. They can't do what they do here, right? And I want to tell you, Germany, the efficiency of German industry is generally recognized to be ahead of ours. So this terrible burden on the capitalist, which in this country would be denounced as killing off jobs and killing off, hasn't had any of those effects in Germany. So very interesting. As are many other social democratic things, right? In France, the law says the minute you go to work, even if you're a young man or woman, you get 5 weeks paid vacation by your boss. That's the law. Everybody gets that. You understand? In France, everybody gets it.
Even a McDonald's worker?
Even a McDonald's worker. Yeah. You get 5 weeks paid vacation because in French culture, that's life. To work all the time is to be a donkey. We are not donkeys. The French word is âne. Not so far from our ass, right? Âne. L'homme n'est pas un âne. You know, we're not donkeys. That's what we get. And they have a national health program and they have subsidized education. The cost to go to the University of Paris is basically nothing. You pay your own room and board, but you don't pay because education is a national thing. We want our people to be educated. We provide education the way we provide a water fountain in the park. Nobody stands there saying, you must pay for the water. Bend over, drink the water. get to ready to go to school, go to school. You don't pay for this thing. It's a different culture, and it's a different left that has been able to get these things. But that left is also able to control, to some degree, what is done with the surplus. I don't want to glorify. There are a lot of problems there. It's a capitalist society over there, too. But it's much more constricted because the left has had much more to say. They have to use a surplus to pay 5 weeks of their people's vacation. They have to. They can't function otherwise. And when they have tried, which they have tried twice in the last 10 years, to go after that, just like there's a subsidy for children. Every child you have in France, the government gives you a subsidy to help you care for and raise the child. The government wanted to reduce those. And I think I told you, into the streets went the Communist Party and the Roman Catholic Church, together marching against the government. The government withdrew the bill within minutes. Within minutes. Couldn't sustain it. It's a different culture. Anyway, we've run out of time. They have another function. Thank you again, and I hope I'll see you again in the future.